My name is Larry Rasmussen, and this is the third of the three sessions on abortion, the moral issues. Today we want to focus on the relationship of morality and law, and the particular questions that arise for us when we talk about the relationship of a moral stand on abortion, whatever it may be, and public policy. I want also today to finish earlier in the hour than I have the last couple of days. That will secure some more time for our discussion. Let me mention that this evening there will be a forum on the topic of abortion to engage the village at large on this subject. That may be particularly appropriate in light of the fact that, as I mentioned yesterday, a note from the White House that the President next week is going to address several social issues, among them abortion. Today's session needs, I think, to be prefaced with just a few remarks on the relationship of morality and law in general, whether we're talking about one particular moral issue such as abortion or about another. There are quite a number of different ways in which morality and law are related, and I mention these by way of background because I think that it may be helpful to our discussion about abortion and public policy. Sometimes morality is translated into law in a rather direct sort of way. So one says that morally it is prohibited to steal. One can translate that into a civil statute and say that in terms of the law of the land, it is also illegal to steal. Or we say, thou shalt not kill is a moral injunction. It is in every society, I suspect, also a legal injunction. Or lying would be another example of something which is both morally wrong and legally wrong. There is a way in which a relationship between morality and law, so that it comes out morality as law. There is also a sense in which morality is by virtue of being in some important ways beyond law. I always think of the English taskmaster's outcry at the children, at the boys in the school. He said, "Boys, be pure in heart, or I'll flog you." Well, there isn't any way in which flogging or not flogging could do much about whether the boys were pure in heart. There are some dimensions of morality which are simply beyond law. They belong to the realm of attitudes and intentions, where the law can do something about regulating our behavior, our actions. It can't do a whole lot, although it can influence. It can't do a whole lot about some dimensions of morality which lie really beyond the reach of law. There is such a thing as morality supportive of, or morality under, or morality as a foundation for law. Chief Justice Warren was fond of saying that that law floats on a sea of ethics. If you don't have at least the moral conviction that's widespread in the populace that law ought to be obeyed, simply worthy of our adherence, then you have, in fact, laws which are unenforceable. So that morality is a necessary support for at least workable laws. Now, we can go the other way as well and talk about the relationship of law to morality. And one thing you might want to note there is that law does shape morality. That's demonstrated in a lot of instances. One that immediately comes to mind was President Truman's integrating of the armed forces about 1948, I think. And that was a study carefully watched by the sociologists who found out that attitudes, as well as practices, between whites and blacks in the armed forces change by virtue of being forced by law into different human relationships. A lot of blacks and whites found that they held stereotypes of each other, and it wasn't until the law said, you have got to live together, eat together, fight together, and you'll do it all together, that those were broken down and values, attitudes were changed. So there is a way in which law shapes morality. Okay, that all by way of preliminaries to our discussion today on abortion and public policy. I did mention yesterday that we Americans tend to be undecided about the relationship of a moral conviction that we hold and public policy. You can scratch an American and you might get a pietist who says, you can't legislate morality. You have to change people's hearts and minds, and that's how you affect change in the society. You've got to go to their hearts and minds, their attitudes, alter their values. Morality flows from character, and character is not formed by legislation, so the pietist says. Some you scratch an American, you might get quite the contrasting response, the Puritan response, who, when he or she sees something that is regarded as morally outrageous, says, there ought to be a law. The pietists and the Puritan are at odds with each other, but both of them belong to American character. You change people by changing society. You embody morality in the law. Good Calvinist notion that you can, in fact, embody morality in law, and that law serves to embody, infuse a particular set of values, so that we have a Puritan streak in us which says sins should also be crimes. Right now on Capitol Hill, some of the proposed abortion on legislation is expressive of this strain that says if it is morally wrong that the fetus is killed, then there ought to be a law that says that is illegal as well as immoral, and it ought to be enforced. So the pietist and then the Puritan, and then the third expression of American character that enters in here is that of the anarchist, who insists that morality is a matter of individual personal choice and we ought to keep the state out of it. Live and let live. These are deeply personal matters and ought to be reside with the autonomy of the responsible individual. So that's sort of background. You can imagine that the debates on the relationship of abortion to public policy might be complex ones, given that kind of set of traditions. What about the law and abortion in particular? And I will share with you some personal convictions, and then we'll open it again. These personal convictions are expressed for the sake of our own coming to clarity. So you may disagree with me, that's fine. The idea is to have something to bounce off of. I think that you can, in part, legislate morality, or at least regulate human behavior by law. So laws on abortion are, at least theoretically, possible as a way of regulating human behavior and influencing morality. Then it becomes a question of what makes for good, workable laws. where moral issues are involved, and especially where controversial moral issues are involved. It might be helpful to say what doesn't make for good laws where controversial moral issues are involved. Moral crusades usually make for bad laws, especially if the morality to be legislated does not itself rest on widespread social consensus. If you've got a moral crusade on the part of a particular sector of the populace, but what they are crusading for isn't widely held in the society, usually that makes for very bad law. It's pretty easy on some issues. Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit murder, thou shalt not commit libel. But all of those represent broadly shared social values. If that is not present, as it was not for adults shall not make nor drink alcoholic beverages, then you have a different situation on your hands. And then you have the case of one devil being exorcised from the house only to have the emptied house filled with about seven others, as Jesus warns in one instance. This is the force of those who fear, in the abortion debate, this is the force of those who fear a sharp rise in illegal and often unsafe abortions. They fear that because there is not widespread social support for legislation on abortions that is highly restrictive of abortions at all stages, therefore you are going to have a great jump in the number of abortions sought illegally, and that will be often from quarters which are unsafe, with the already poor suffering the most. Interesting instance of this kind of thinking about abortion by a person who is conservative on abortion as a moral decision is the case of former Representative Robert Drynan, a Jesuit from Massachusetts, who, as you know, upon orders from the Pope, was told not to run again in the last election. So he is no longer there. Robert Drynan was a dean of law school in Massachusetts before he came to Washington. He was always in trouble with his Roman Catholic colleagues, and they would, because he favored liberal laws on abortion, and they said, "My goodness, don't you know where we stand on this?" And Robert Drynan says, "I stand in the same place you do. I can think of very few instances where I'm in favor of abortion, and the ones I can think of are basically the same as the ones that you hold. But I do not think that highly restrictive laws can be enforced. They do not have some broad enough support, as best I can see right now, for such laws, and we're going to have to do much more in the society at large to generate a consensus." So Drynan turned out to be conservative on abortion in terms of its moral rightness or wrongness, and in favor of, at least for the time being, rather liberal laws. One time I put my name along with other signatories on a piece that ran in the Christianity Crisis and Christian Century and New York Times and Washington Post and so on. And it was a piece in opposition to a proposed bill at that time submitted by Representative Hyde, an amendment, actually. And the mail that I got in response to having my name there with the others was a lot of hate mail, and it was wrongly directed. And I looked back to see if the statement itself would have led to that, or if people were responding without reading carefully. My own stand, compared with a lot of others, is, I suppose, depending on where you draw the comparison, of course, rather conservative, but I oppose this particular amendment for the grounds that we've just talked about. I think it would have resulted in very bad law. But the response to me in the mail was, why do you take that stand on abortion? See, there was the Puritan assumption operating in every bit of mail I got that every sin ought to be a crime. There was a one-to-one relationship between a moral judgment and a legal policy. Okay, then the next thing I want to say has to do with the relationship of a moral act and a public policy, a legal policy. The Puritanism in us says that if an act is morally wrong, we should counter with a correcting policy in law. The problem is that a policy and its moral dimensions is far more complex than a moral act. What would it take to enforce a policy saying that all or nearly all abortions are wrong? What would the consequences be of enforcing a law that says all abortions are wrong? That introduces some complexities that deciding on the rightness or the wrongness of the act does not. An act and a policy have a complex relationship with one another. I'll read you one person if I can find it. Maybe I can't find it in time. A piece by Ellen Goodman. Now she is coming from a particular point of view on the rightness or wrongness of abortions, and you ought to know that in the first instance, because that no doubt also informs her comments on the prospects of the law. But here is at least an argument that says the morality of a policy is different from the morality of an act. She is talking about the Human Life Amendment, and she says, it says that this right to life of the fetus is paramount to the right of privacy or of a woman or a family. To enforce this right to life, aborted women and their doctors would surely be charged with murders. IUDs would in all likelihood also be banned. But the amendment would also ultimately require a massive hunt, a government edict to investigate miscarriages, to oversee the habits of pregnant women and monitor research from genetic screening to amniocentesis. This is not fantasy, it is probability. Her contention is then that if you had a law that on a public policy, then you would need to talk about how that would be enforced. And in this case, you would end up needing, if you were serious about it, needing to investigate, quote, miscarriages, needing to investigate different forms of birth control, etc. And I'm saying one does need to talk about the consequences of translating morality into law at that point. So that a judgment about the morality of an act is not by itself simultaneously a judgment about the morality of a policy. All right, let me just stop there and we can discuss items from the last couple of days as well as today. The first day, talking about some of the factual matters around abortion. These days, talking about the proposed amendment and Senate resolution on Capitol Hill. Yesterday, talking about some of the issues around abortion as the taking of life, why protect life, was part of that discussion. And today, talking about the relationship of a law on abortion to public policy, I mean, to the morality of the taking of life itself. We can talk about any of those as far as I'm concern? No, let's just open it up here. Yeah,
well,
Kara?
Larry, one thing I sort of, I don't have a statement to make on this, but I sort of like to have a little more information on the statistical breakdown of what's going on in the United States right now. You know, you have these figures of the number of abortions that are being performed. And then we talk about some of the types of abortions that perhaps a lot of us would say they're very well within the realm of acceptability, such as the pre-sex child and stuff like this.
Yes.
And yet, when we look at what's really going on, I don't have figures on that, but I strongly suspect that the number of abortions that many of us would feel are justifiable are so very small.
Mm.
And that the ones that are going on that, you know, we just couldn't in all right accept because they're often a matter of convenience. This is my guess.
Yes.
And, you know, I think that's something we should look at when we listen to all the various arguments, because we can be overshadowed with great feelings of remorse and care and concern for certain groups. And, I mean, I do.
Mm-hmm.
I do have great concern
mm-hmm.
for certain groups of people who are in terrific minds. But then, so we keep that in some kind of perspective of what's really going on.
Yeah.
And I don't think we have figures on that, but
yeah, that's a good point. I don't have figures on that, but if, in fact, you are talking about the number of abortions and the ratio of that to reported live births as one abortion for every three live births, then certainly you are talking about a lot of abortions that do not fall into the categories that we talked about yesterday in terms of certain classes of genetically deformed. And so on. I mean, you must be talking about a very large number of abortions there, where the reason resides with the not the condition of the fetus, but the state of and situation of the prospective mother, where, in different terms, you would expect in many, many instances normal development of the fetus. I think that's a safe kind of assumption. Yeah.
Okay. I think you just sort of categorized something. I don't like to sit in judgment on that, but I think that the terminology being used is probably convenience abortions as against the justifiable, as you said. But okay, if we're going to look at convenience abortions, then I think when we talk about abortion, we're talking about a symptom, not the problem. It's the same thing as if you had somebody with a temperature of 105 and you stick them in the bath with ice water and it gets down to 98.6, you call it cure. The bigger problem is, as Marge, I think, brought up yesterday, somehow only the female is sexually responsible. That's an attitude. If we talk about the symptom of abortion, then we're missing the point. Let's go to our society's attitudes. That's an important thing.
How long is that going to take? How long is that going to take?
How much effort is going to be put on it?
How many years are we going to invest in looking at attitudes and changing them? And
how many years do we want to invest in fighting the symptom instead of looking at the cause?
Well, why can't both be looked at?
Okay, but where's all the energy going? You divert it.
What was that?
Where's the energy going? Have you ever tried to divert the energy? Have you ever tried to divert the energy from the symptom to the cause?
Have I personally tried? Is that what you're asking?
Well, it's clear to me that...
Go ahead.
It's not clear to me that one can establish that attitudes toward who is responsible for pregnancy or who bears the burden of a sexual act is the only cause for abortion in this country.
We didn't say it was the only. We just sorted out.
But you were talking about causes and symptoms, or the cause and symptoms.
No. She used the term justifiable, defective, you know, this kind of thing, okay? Justifiable versus convenience. So then I took the convenience one, then let's call those the symptom, not the cause.
You know, despite the ERA and something like that, females get pregnant and men don't. I mean, that's a fact of life, and no legislation can ever change that. Sorry, it's the way life is.
No one's trying.
Huh?
No one's trying, but it still takes two to create a pregnancy.
Takes two to tango, right, or tango. Or
no, two to create a pregnancy.
Yeah. But the female gets pregnant, though. And she better take more care of them. I mean, it's
who should take more care?
I don't get pregnant, I'm sorry. I never get pregnant.
You mean,
by the way, I have taken care, by the way.
Okay.
Forever.
But okay, but the thing we're saying, if you got back to the basic premise that every act is a responsible act, we wouldn't be wasting all this money, all this fight, all this action. We could, instead of trying to eliminate total abortion, who would be so criminal as to make a woman who has gone through a rape?
That was
that's what's coming out of the way it's going. No. I'm saying sort that up.
We define it as justifiable yesterday. I think it was one of Larry's criteria.
But that's not what the amendment in Congress is going to take
discussing
care.
That. We're discussing the morality of the issue.
But the Congress, congressional action is next to
But a further question is to relate it to today's subject is if you did decide that it was a symptom, and if you went after causes, what place does law play in addressing those causes? I mean, law does play a role in shaping social attitudes. In fact, a very effective role. So, did you have some particular law in mind that you thought would be appropriate for this long-term shaping of social attitudes?
No, I'm not sure that, you know, but this kind of thing, I don't go to the law for everything. I think it's education more than law in this situation.
Mm-hmm. Education of what?
Of people.
Like Carol Manning said yesterday, a lot of teenage pregnancies occur because they're simply, the teenagers simply didn't know. I mean, very basic facts. Sex education wasn't present at an early enough age.
I think that's part of it. I think part of it is just attitudinal. You know, it's like, it's fine for the guy to go out and sew Wild Oats on Saturday night and church Sunday morning for crop failure. But that's the end of his responsibility. And this kind of prevailing thing that
Yeah, there certainly has, and there still remains a double standard in
that's
sexual
right.
morality between male and female.
But yeah. it's that, you know, there needs some attitudinal changes from, you know, age on up. And I think Marsh brought up something on Monday night, you know, that this kind of second-class status that women accept. And I just couldn't, I said, but you know, that's why women put up with this battering. Husband beats them up, and they stay with him. He beats them up, and, you know, they lose their teeth, their broken bones and everything, and they stay with him. And it's this kind of gap that's being proclaimed, and by a total force is trying to make us go back to that second-class status for women.
Yeah, there are centuries of changes to be made there. Back when someone asked me one time if I knew of the Bible making any statement about an abortion whatsoever, I could only think of one instance, and it's in Exodus, where a miscarriage is mentioned. It says that if two males are fighting, and by accident a woman, pregnant woman, is injured, and the injury causes a miscarriage, then the husband of the woman is has the right to fine the male who injured the woman who had the miscarriage. She wasn't asked. He could impose the fine. Why? Because the woman was his property. The actual penalties for such as kidnapping were much worse than a woman being injured and suffering a miscarriage.
The two terms we've been using, justifiable and convenience.
Yeah, that wasn't, those aren't my terms.
No, that's
no, I know, they just yeah. came out, but I think it is the way people do think about many abortions that are performed, that they were just performed for full convenience, and I don't think that we can know that just across the board.
Right.
I think you have to know each individual person and that person's needs, and the environment that she's in, and the support that she may or may not have, and her age, and her body, and, you know, to say that it just may be for convenience, it may look like that on the outside, from the outside, or from even from the legal view, but it may indeed not be.
From the point of view of the person contemplating abortion, it's probably a very serious decision, and to call it convenience may not be doing it justice at all. I mean, what I prefer to talk about is whether you're talking about the condition of the fetus or you're talking about conditions surrounding the prospective mother.
That's wonderful. And, but we sometimes assume from outward behavior that people don't care when these things are happening to them. I remember, for instance, being in the hospital when one of our children was born, and a very young woman was beside me in the bed in the ward, and she had born a child and was giving up her adoption and seemed totally uncaring. But in the night she cried and wept and cried very quietly, but I could hear her. I was very much aware of what she was going through. And, you know, we have this kind of romantic mystique possibly about someone going through that process of pregnancy, bringing a child, a live child into the world and offering for adoption. Perhaps not realizing the pain of giving it up and the pain that adopted child will go through as he or she tries to adjust to having been given up. We have one adopted child, so I can speak about that personally. And it's an incredible struggle, too. So there's a lot that we don't know.
Yes. The question that I want to keep pressing is, because there is such a wide variety of cases, different circumstances, what does that mean if you are talking about public policy? I mean, what do you conclude? Presumably, you can fashion a law that addresses each individual case. The law, by virtue of being law, can at best address classes of cases. And I wanted to get back here because that was an important point that you brought up. The question that comes up, though, is what are the implications if we want to talk about a law regulating abortions? I mean,
I'm not going to add anything more to it. You're doing a great job.
No, that's the question. That's
I'm wondering about this must surely be discussed at length in medical schools and medical associations, and I mean, they're the people that have to carry this out, and I would think that would be a terrible burden for a doctor with no definitive law one way or the other.
Well, right now there is. Right now there is the Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, I know, but
very
I mean,
clear.
Depending on the, this is one of the legal implications is, I would think that the medical associations themselves or individual doctors or something would be putting a lot of input in, and I'm wondering what kinds of generalities they come out with.
That's a good question. What kind of, what is being represented on Capitol Hill now, for example, by medical interest? Paul?
I'm not sure of my facts here, but I seem to recall in the last few months the AMA's representative testifying in favor of not interfering with the Supreme Court's decision,
so
arguing that prior to lease of liability, the matter is between the physician and the mother.
So, well, that's a helpful.
Not because abortion statement. Is right, but because of the privacy relationship between.
Yeah.
And the tremendous amount of paperwork you have to get and legal work you have to get involved in with any other kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't know what the other reason. But as I said, I'm not absolutely sure.
It's because of the privacy relationship. So, in a sense, the medical physician said, yeah, that's morally of great significance to the medical profession. And secondly, I would think that they are also afraid of the difficulties of operating with a highly restrictive law. I mean, at least the present law, whatever you think about abortion, is a workable one from the side of the medical
physicians are being policed.
Yeah.
And the way it's working out in practicality, I come from a medical setting, is that doctors are then free to choose not to participate in abortions, and hospitals also.
That's right.
Are free to choose not to participate, and so it's kept at the local or private level.
Some hospitals, I know Roman Catholic hospitals, where it is a policy of the particular hospital not to perform abortions, which are legal by law, but the hospital has the right to do it, and so they instruct medical staff when they hire them of the hospital policies, which is protective of conscience, among other things. Yeah.
Only if there are available hospitals, you say.
That's right.
Oh yeah, that's an important qualifier. Yeah. Marge?
Well, I would feel that your action on the Hyde Amendment was probably a good one, and the thought behind it, I think you would just simply have a lot of food like abortion. Yeah, that kind of thing.
But a lot of people in this country are very dissatisfied with the present state of affairs and really do want something different. I'm not in a good position to do prognosis, but I would be quite surprised if we didn't get something other than the present arrangements out of the present discussion on Capitol Hill.
From the abortion counseling, we do a fairly conservative the abortion counseling that we're called upon to do in a fairly conservative part of the country in Orange County. I would say that it's one that doesn't have support and popular in the grassroots.
What doesn't have?
An amendment.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it could be enforced. There are just too many people out there who, when it comes to their own particular personal situation, regardless of what they have previously professed, when others have been in that situation and say have condemned abortion, when it comes to their situation, when, say, a 55-year-old father with children from a previous marriage and children from the present marriage finds out that his wife is pregnant, and former attitudes were very fundamentalist, and then suddenly is faced with his own situation, and considers that an option, a viable option. I just think that you just couldn't enforce that kind of a law.
Some polls have indicated that something like a majority of Americans do in fact favor the present arrangement. But you have very strong and well-organized lobbying working for something different from that.
Yes? Here's a question about the discussion that you had, Larry, regarding the different stages of the growth of the fetus. And it has to do with a concern that I have in regards to litigation and the arriving at evidence which will support a given case. And I was wondering if I'm not correct in thinking that the earlier in the stage of the presence or the growth of the fetus, the more it is a private matter between at least a man and a woman. And where we're in the latter stages, it is a matter of evidence that could be arrived at out of the operating room, for example, when a fetus has been aborted in, say, just prior to a viable stage. In other words, I'm wondering if you take a different, along this scale from day one to the ninth month,
mm-hmm.
that you would get into a great amount of differentiation with regards to the arriving at evidence in a court that was trying to establish guilt on the part of somebody.
And you're saying that later is easier?
Yes, by far.
Yeah.
But you got a nurse who was present at this,
sure,
at this, on this operating day. Whereas at an early stage, you might have, for example, I was thinking about this yesterday, we were talking about it. We're getting into more and more cases of more and more reasons for a man and a woman to dissolve their marriage at an early stage, let's say at the fourth month, the very act of the pregnancy. It could be a cause of the dissolution of the marriage. So in that case, it might easily be the dissolving male who would be, he's not dissolving, but he's dissolving. The dissolving male might very well be the one who is desirous, in certain circumstances, of that child. He might go to court to prevent this ex from aborting this child. It's conceivable, isn't it?
Yes.
So what I'm saying is that you get more and more back into a private realm of the relationship, the private relationship between a man and a woman in the earlier stages of a fetus. Is that correct?
Okay.
I don't know where that goes, except
yeah,
I'm
concerned
about it.
I was just going to ask what implications,
okay,
of
the
that
implications
are for law.
Well, the implications would be that in America, you are innocent until proved guilty. So in each of these instances, whatever public policy comes up with is going to have to be reflected in the forms of evidence,
yeah,
that will be admitted in a given situation.
Yes.
So so I would think that it would be reasonable to talk about viability versus non-viability if we were talking about how one is going to litigate against someone.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Yes. You're really underscoring what Ellen Goodman was talking about, the difficulty of enforcing the law at the early stages of pregnancy, and what it would take to do that, and only you're bringing up the fact that the evidence admitted by law and court runs into all kinds of problematical aspects at the early points of pregnancy.
That plus the delay in getting it on the court docket. It's a year and a half in Pierce County.
Yeah, that's relatively swift.
But doesn't it also violate the confidentiality between the doctor and the wife or the woman who's carrying the baby? What happens between that relationship with the law?
Well, it would violate the present understanding of that relationship.
Yes.
That's certain.
I mean, we go to physicians for a variety of problems, okay? Ailments or sickness or whatever. And the doctor's going to be confidential with my asking him not to tell someone that I have cancer until I'm ready to tell someone myself or whatever other disease I might have. But yet, if I'm pregnant and I should confide in him that I don't want the baby or I would like to abort it, or what happens? Does he go and tell somebody and then they, under the law, and then they arrest me, or what do they do?
Well, I think the medical profession will press very, lobby very hard at that point. But if one is asking what, in fact, would happen if you pass the present proposed constitutional amendment, it would take the form of doctors simply being told that they could not perform abortion. Period. I mean, and that's, the woman comes, the doctor says, no, I cannot.
What happens if I go into a little back room and have it done illegally, and then I have some complications, and I go to my doctor, what happens then?
Good question.
Well, we've got business, aren't there things like this? Yeah, we should clear the R. I can't remember the case involving an FBI search for a person with a very rare skin disease about 15 years ago. And the AMA fought this. But the question was whether or not the FBI's claim that it could prosecute any physician who knowingly did not turn in evidence that a person with that very rare disease had come to that physician would stand up in court. The AMA argued that the physicians did not have to turn in that evidence to the FBI. Oddly enough, it was voted for. The case, it seems to me that the case did not get resolved, but it didn't get high enough to be resolved.
Is the physician required to report to the police when somebody's treated for gunshot wounds or stabbings? Yes.
Child abuse.
Yes.
I thought you made a good case, you know, in terms of crusades don't make for good legislation. We certainly are aware of that in terms of prohibition and some other things. And yet, the cause, as you know, as people see it in terms of a issue such as abortion, really is sort of parallel to people who have deep beliefs about disarmament. It is a cause in which, you know, propagates itself, and they hear the child, the potential life, you know, and some desire for curbing of what presently is going on is their push. You know, some of them push for the whole thing, and some of them hope we'll get something less, you know, at least not funding as much or prohibitions of some type. And I guess my own instance, I'm sort of perplexed about what I would like to do to see it curb some. And I guess that's where I'm at. I think we've gone in the wrong direction, too far in one direction, yet I don't really know. I don't want to make it into a great crusade, and yet morally, I'm under great discomfort in terms of the as I am with the way in which our government is going in terms of nuclear, you know, bombs. I don't know what to do about either one of those, you know, except you march, you protest, you know, and you hope that there are going to be some answers, you know, within the Christian community. But I'm sure that the people who feel strongly about this will not go away.
No.
And they are going to try to get something. No matter, you know, if we say it's a crusade or not a crusade.
Now that's why
something is coming.
That's why Carol's first question here is an important one. If we did decide that these cases and those cases were morally justified abortions, severe genetic deformities, clear instance of conflict between the life of the fetus and the life of the mother. You know, and there was widespread social consensus for that. What yet do we do about the large number of those where one would expect normal fetal development and where something could, in fact, be done to care for the child, whether it was the biological mother or not? It's at that point that the question keeps pressing itself, it seems to me. What kinds of laws would be workable if you felt strongly that it is not simply a matter between woman and physician in those kinds of instances? Or we keep having to press toward what makes for workable laws when that moral passion is present, and even present, you know, rather widespread way.
As a chunk, and then is there any discussion given among theologians or about the potential development of an artificial womb. It's going to happen someday that you can take a fertilized egg and place it in this artificial womb and it'll carry the fetus a full 9 months.
Well, we have.
Is there any thought there that maybe life is discontinuous from the time of fertilization?
The question is not whether life is continuous. That certainly is the case.
I guess I don't understand the difference between the first trimester and second trimester. I think that's an arbitrary, just an arbitrary decision. There's no real.
There certainly is a continuum where you don't have, you know, sharply different lines developmentally. The question is at what point society says we protect life for the following reasons. You know.
Mary, I think it's important to ask ourselves if we do try to press for any kind of legislation, whether we're doing it out of conviction that abortion is morally wrong, or whether we're doing it out of a perhaps hidden from our own selves desire to have power over other people's decision making.
Erling Jorstad earlier in the summer did a number of sessions on the merging of the new Christian right and the new political right. And whether you accept his judgment or not, his contention was that what's happening now in many quarters is a kind of politics of revenge and resentment. And that a lot of efforts at lobbying at Capitol Hill are for laws really to get somebody, you know, who outraged folks who have themselves felt offended by liberals for some time. Ken?
Is there anything even talked about in any kind of circles about laws which would advocate alternatives to that, such as federal funding or state funding for adoptions.
Yeah.
We don't allow funding for abortions and expect people to carry full term. I'm just throwing this out in a thought. All right. Yeah. In other words, moving from the punitive to the compassion, which I think you're implying is we need to do, get out of getting them.
Mm-hmm.
And all right, if we are going to say that the society is going to care for all children, then we fund that as a society, not the individual, especially when there is mistakes, etc. done. Now that's a controversy on the opposite end of the line.
That, I mean, I'll just respond with my personal conviction on that. I think we have done very little.
Never talked about
society
positive
in
science.
Developing alternatives to abortion
health.
Where you can tell the pregnant woman that whatever her decision is, there is the guarantee, as best society can guarantee anything, the care of the child. We've really done very little.
I don't think we can have either one or the other. Punitive come off, they're on their own. That's what I'm sensing a lot of what's going on here.
Yeah.
I think taking your first day thrust of you've got to answer both sides with the same belief system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. The life of the child is fine, but what about the care of that child too?
Yeah.
And so this issue lies in the whole aspect of the post 9 month dynamic as well, and public policy is being either ignored or butchered at that line as well.
At that point, those theological claims, life is a created good, dignity, respect, compassion, etc., should inform pressing much harder for alternatives to abortion than we have. I think our time is about up, and I just wanted to conclude with one item also from trying to get some Christian perspective on the issue. A technical term, but a helpful one in Christian ethics is the phrase the transmoral good. If we're going to debate hard issues where people are going to be set against each other because of moral judgments which conflict dramatically as they do, in the matter of abortion. One thing that we can try to keep in mind, even though it runs against the passion of the debate, is that there is a good which transcends the arguments about right and wrong between people. And that's at the heart, actually, of Christian faith. Our talk of justification by grace through faith says that God does not judge God's acceptance of us on the basis of how well we rank on a moral scale and where we came out in terms of moral performance, whether our moral judgments were right or whether our moral judgments were wrong. One other time we did these discussions on abortion this summer, and one of the persons said, "I'm so at odds with my sister on this matter of abortion that we've quit talking with one another, and I don't think we're going to get back to talking with one another until we resolve the issue of abortion between us." Well, there may be a possibility of talking even with the all of our feelings out there to the other in a way that starts with a basic acceptance of those others, not because we agree or disagree with them on a particular moral issue, but because there's something much more fundamental, namely that what holds us together is God's unconditional acceptance. And if we're not measured on a moral scale by God in terms of that acceptance, then we have the further responsibility to address the other without judging him or her as a person because of the particular moral judgment on a particular issue. So the relationship of the transmoral good to moral good, right and wrong, is a terribly important one. Otherwise, I can't carry on a debate about which I feel, you know, terribly strongly without writing off the other person who disagrees with me, or else without, you know, saying, "You and I are the allies here, let's get together, and if we do it right, we'll win." The whole business of winning and losing is radically relativized by a notion that there is a good which transcends the whole notion of winning and losing as a place to begin. So I don't know how, very often it's very difficult to inject that kind of attitude into a debate itself. But insofar as it is possible to color a debate that is passionate by saying, "All right, whether you're right or whether I'm right, whether you win on this legislative battle or I win on this legislative battle, we are, after all, common members of a common family, and we're going to have to live with each other." And essentially, the dignity and the respect that is accorded all of life is reflected in my attitude toward you and yours toward me, and nothing, no matter how we come out on the issue, erases that dignity or respect, because it doesn't matter whether you win or lose, but it's a derivative from the value of life itself in God.